Welcome to Cowan Nights. News boss Frank Shires is here, as is chairman of the board, Shane Peterson. I am Mike Lewis. This show is going to spend a fair bit of time on a lot of stuff going on in Olympia because, of course, in just a few minutes, we're going to have Hannah Scott on the show. But it is not just limited to her. We also have an attorney from the ACLU to talk about some pretty major criminal justice reforms, including a chance to, it may not happen this session, but it certainly is going to happen, to remove the requirement for cash bail. Already one state has done it, Illinois. There's an interesting argument to be made about it. I'm sure there's going to be people who are unhappy about it, particularly bail bondsmen. But first, we've got we've got a lot of immediate news coming on here. Before we get to Hannah, the U.S. is poised to get its third COVID-19 vaccine, which is excellent news. CBS News' Madeline Rivera reports that an independent FDA advisory committee voted Friday night tonight to greenlight the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine, which is what we were hoping for and expecting.
That paves the way for the FDA to grant emergency use authorization.
There is a shortage of vaccines that are currently authorized, and I think authorization of this vaccine will help meet the needs at the moment.
The FDA confirms that J&J's vaccine is slightly less effective than the Moderna and Pfizer shots overall, but showed 85% efficacy against severe illness and complete protection against COVID-19 deaths 28 days after getting the shot. Madeline Rivera, CBS News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
Also, what is going to be happening tonight potentially is another aid package, a giant one, coronavirus response package from the Senate. We will see what is going to happen, and we'll try and update you as the evening rolls on. The Biden administration, it released, this has been, this would be more of a blockbuster if we didn't know a lot of this information, but the fact that they're moving ahead with it, and making it public is a good thing. Today, the Biden administration released the long-awaited intelligence report on the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The Trump administration had refused to declassify it. It points the finger squarely at Crown Prince and future king of Saudi Arabia, which is a key U.S. ally. We get more now from CBS's Margaret Brennan.
Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Turkey in October 2018 while his fiancée waited outside. Inside, he was brutally murdered and dismembered by a 15-member hit squad flown in from Saudi Arabia. A U.S. intelligence report tonight said it included members of the elite personal protective detail for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whom the U.S. assesses personally approved the kill or capture mission.
This has been a source of great consternation. In fact, not just a source of consternation between Saudi Arabia and the United States. A source between Saudi Arabia and Turkey, because that's exactly where Khashoggi was. He was not in Saudi Arabia. He was actually in Turkey, went into the Saudi Arabian embassy there, and that's where he was attacked and killed in some back room there when he was supposedly getting his visa. And so what that meant also to the Saudis was that the embassy was effectively being watched by the Turkish authorities, who then released that information to the United States. So it's created sort of a three-way bit of tension, because I think that the Turks did not want to be known as the people who release information, although there really was no other way for us to get that anyway. So what's happened now is it's going to be, well, it may be just a tempest in a teapot. Certainly, he's not going to be deposed, the Crown Prince, and there was no actual sanctions. The U.S. still depends pretty heavily on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia still depends pretty heavily on the United States in that area. So my guess is there's going to be a lot of finger wagging, and no one really is going to pay the price. There was some sort of kangaroo court regarding some lower-level Saudi Arabian operatives who purportedly did the killing, but it appears that that was probably not exactly what was going on. And lastly, before we jump into the criminal justice reform stuff, this looks like the big pivot point on the aid package that is supposed to be coming out from Congress is on the $15 federal minimum wage, and that is it looks like that legislation may be effectively dead. It's not clear what the Democrats are going to find some other way to get around that. They were talking about finding some way to penalize companies, to sort of back end it, to penalize companies that are not giving a $15 minimum wage. But it appears that even some of their own members are not terribly comfortable with that. So we are going to, it looks like, we're going to be bringing you updates as soon as we know a little bit more about this. And right now, criminal justice reform is a primary focus of lawmakers in Olympia, from changes that would allow felons to vote post-service of their sentences to police accountability measure. Joining us now is Cairo's own Hannah Scott to talk about this. Among the bills that are up are felons being allowed to vote and other reforms. What is the preeminent one right now, Hannah?
Police reform was the big deal going into session, of course, after the death of George Floyd and all the protests that we saw over the summer here in Seattle and across the nation. Almost immediately, many lawmakers in Olympia started to do work on this. There was also, you know, the independent investigations into police deadly use of force cases that the governor called for. We've had some of our own incidents here in the state, and it just kind of all formulated into this big thing where at one point right before session, there was like 60 police reform, police accountability bills on the table that got whittled down to maybe 30 by the time session started. And now we're near the halfway point of session. We're seeing what's going to move, what's not maybe going to make it this time. But some of these are big asks, right? There's a qualified immunity bill out there. There was some arbitration limitations for what we see in Seattle to basically take the union contract out of the disciplinary process, if you will. And a lot of big lifts that, maybe aren't going to happen right now. One big one, though, that was centered, all of these bills were centered around, was from Democratic Senator Jamie Peterson, a sweeping police accountability bill that was approved in the Senate late last night. He explained the need.
Video, another video, and another video of black neighbors getting killed by police. We have constructed and then tolerated a system that has led to people regularly being killed without any due process. It is time that we turn the page, that we start to remake a system that can do justice for everyone.
Now, this does sweeping changes, as was described to me, as kind of the teeth of the police accountability efforts, which there's been none of, right? There's been no actual punishment for any of the things that we see in I-940 if they're violated, things like that. Right. So this would cover that in what's known as the decertification process of officers. Think of it as a doctor or a nurse who has a license in order to do their job. That's what decertification or certification is. It's handled by the Criminal Justice Training Commission. And this would really lay out a process, because it never, ever happens. Just like you don't see cops prosecuted in use of force cases, and if they've got misconduct or behaving badly, nothing really happens. And our current system is set up in a way where a cop that works in Seattle who's going through arbitration after being disciplined can see the writing on the wall and see that they're going to get fired and it's going to end badly for them, so they can quit and they can lateral, because the police agencies do not communicate amongst one another, and there's no database that says this officer's been involved in this discipline action over this department. So that's what's been happening all the time. So you'll see even like longtime state patrol and former Snohomish County Sheriff John Lovick is behind this. He's in the legislature, you know, and that's what this does. It changes what the Criminal Justice Training Commission does. Instead of making the training their top priority, it makes their top priority that certification and decertification process. It also adds more civilians on that commission. So I believe it's civilian heavy as opposed to more cops than civilians on it. And that's a big issue for many in the police groups. And then it creates a database. There's mandatory reporting for all discipline that for every agency around the state that's publicly searchable. And that's a huge deal, because normally that is classified information, not open to public records. So that's a little bit about what's in this bill. There's more to it. But the Republicans pushed back hard against this last night.
But these brave men and women go through, to be treated like this is just plain wrong. And I'll be voting no.
I believe that this is such a radical upheaval. It has so poisoned the well with good law-abiding law enforcement officers that it could do more harm than good.
So we know there are bad actors out there, but the vast majority of our police officers are good, honest, respectable friends and neighbors. How many of us know what it's like to go out there and put your life on the line every day? Not many of us. Not many of us. But here we are. We're making decisions left and right. And I got to tell you, we keep doing this. Why would anybody want to be a police officer?
So that went on. This was a nearly 4-hour debate that went on. There was a lot of amendments from the Republicans that didn't, they all failed. And you saw this really big divide. Not all of the police reform bills that are in the legislature right now have that much divisiveness to them. This one really does, because it really makes some significant changes in the oversight of police.
Wow, that is going to be that's a big deal, because that is changing really kind of fundamentally.
Yes.
What's happening in Washington State right now? All right. So what was the state? What was the legislature's reaction, or will there be one, to the Washington Supreme Court decision? And effectively, if people are accurate, saying legalizing personal use amounts of drugs, or at least making them non-prosecutable.
Right. So, and this is such a simple thing. And it was interesting. I did not know this until I looked into it last night. Other states that had these, the issues with their laws that we just were found to have yesterday, they all cleared this. They changed a long time ago. We were the last state in the nation that still had a law in the books worded the way that we did. And the issue with this law is that it does not require the prosecutor to prove that the person who was busted knew they had the drugs on them, whether it's on their person, in their car, wherever it might be. It was centered around the case of a woman who had a tiny amount of meth in like her jeans pocket, and she said it was a friend of hers who had bought them from a secondhand store a couple of days before. They didn't fit, so she gave them to her, and she was walking around and not knowing the meth was there. And there's no way to prove one way or the other, so that's the issue. It just needs the word knowing in there, according to State Senator Mark Mullett. He's a Democrat, moderate Democrat. Him and Democrats Senator Steve Hobbs, they dropped this bill today to make this quick fix, just adding that language into the existing law, saying you have to be able to say that they knew that they had it. You have to be able to prove that. And he thinks that will fix this, and that the legislature can get this up, take care of this very quickly. I'm not so sure about that. I spoke with the House Public Safety Committee chairman. Any bill like this would have to go through him, or the Law and Justice Committee in the Senate. And he said, no, we really need to dive into this ruling and see what it all means and what it says, and be very deliberate about what we do. Plus, there's deadlines, and we're near the deadline right now to get any kind of policy change. It'd have to be an emergency. And he sounded like he was not convinced that there could be agreement on what needs to happen, because in the backdrop of all of this, there is a separate bill right now. It's House Bill 1499 that would, in fact, decriminalize small personal amounts of drugs statewide. That is really seen, it has a lot of momentum. It's something that prosecutors had agreed to. They'd worked the bill out, and it was going to kick in maybe 2023. The idea here is similar to what Oregon just did, is invest much, much more in various kinds of treatment, not inpatient treatment, but various services that can be on demand for people with substance use disorder, because that's usually who you're talking about if you're talking about the small amounts of drugs, right? So there's the big push to get that done in Olympia on the Democratic side, but then you've got Republicans who are like, no, we don't know that that's necessarily the right move. So he didn't think there could be agreement. In the meantime, there's no law in the books right now. So all of the prosecutors are going through all their old cases to have to dismiss and clear and let people out of jail who might be in jail for just that simple possession.
Wow. So that is it's going to be a mess. Is it something that they're prepared, that the Democrats are prepared to roll through without something on the books if they can't get another deal done?
I seriously can't imagine that happening. And the folks, it's fairly new still. It's a really busy time because of the deadline that's coming right now in the next few days. So they're trying to pass bills off the floor. I think they have to get something done absolutely this session. You can't leave it as is. It's a nightmare, because it's not even just people who are locked up. The ripple effect from this is insane.
Oh,
you've got people who, we have the offender score. The offender score is calculated based on whatever priors you have, and those priors can include this simple possession. So if you're right now serving time because you got busted for your third time for something, if you've got your offender score that led to your sentence calculated off of two prior simple possessions, maybe you have to get your sentence reduced. Maybe you get out. It's a whole thing. And in the meantime, cops, all our agencies are saying, we're not going to arrest it. We can't arrest people now for simple possession. And that was also a tool to use for probable cause, to look in deeper and see if maybe, you know, there's a kilo of coke in the back or something or whatever. That's what the officers would use this tool for. And now they don't have that on the table either. Plus, drug court. Everybody who was in drug court for simple possession, where they're starting to get treatment, they're getting some services, they're getting kicked out now.
Wow. So, all right, we got time for one more.
Sorry.
No. Don't be sorry. This is why, exactly why we call you. So, last one, felons and the right to vote. What is going to be the outcome there? It looks like that thing is going to move through without a whole lot of difficulty, or am I wrong?
There's pushback. I think that you know, it's going to go through the Senate. I can't imagine it doesn't go through the Senate. And it's something that's been pushed for several years. And it is really seen as a central part of the equity, racial equity, ending of systemic racism effort that is going on in Olympia. Again, kind of an offshoot of what we saw with the protests and everything over the last year or so. This is a big deal because the idea and the growing belief, not just here among Democrats in our state, but there's research and study after study that shows the problem with what we did with, you know, the war on drugs and all this really heavy-handed law enforcement stuff was we send people to jail for, you know, minor pot possession or something back in the 80s and for years, and they come out and they've got a felony on their record. They can't get a job. They can't get a place to live. They have no hope. So it just perpetuates the cycle and recidivism and all of that. That's no longer the belief that's the way that's going to work, because obviously it hasn't worked. So
right,
they're shifting the other way and they can't vote. So giving these people the right to vote is something that is really, really supported among Democrats. The current law, you have to, if you're a felon who serves your time and you get out, you have to go through this two-step process and ask for your rights back. This bill automatically gives you your voting rights back. It also does away with, and this is a big deal, a really hotly debated issue right now, if the current law allows you to, they can take your voting rights away again if you are late on your fees or your restitution or whatever it might be that was court ordered. This does away with that because that is seen as very, very racist. It's seen as going against the low-income people of color are disproportionately affected because they can't afford their fees and they just stay locked in the cycle.
Yeah, this is one of those ones. And on top of that, I mean, given the voting rate in this country anyway, it doesn't seem to me like holding that over their head, like pay restitution or you won't get the right to vote, doesn't to me seem, it's historically not been a super effective means to get people there. It's never made a whole lot of sense to me anyway. All right, Hannah, I think that is all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Always happy to be here.
More Cairo Nights right after the break. Stay tuned. Back to Cairo Nights. This is a bit of legislation. We're talking a lot about bills in Washington. They're all moving through kind of quickly. Some of them are really, really important. Hannah brought up from police accountability to felons getting their right to vote back. And this one, wow, this one is going to be, I imagine that some of you listening are going to be pretty unhappy about this. There's probably going to be some of you listening who are happy about this, and maybe a few of other you, I don't know. I'm pretty happy about this, generally speaking. I mean, to be completely honest, I don't know that I see a strong need for this particular thing. But Let's talk about it first, and then we can get into the reasons why. Joseph O'Sullivan's story in the Seattle Times. This is the top of his story. After an emotional debate that highlighted and lamented America's sharp political divisions, the Washington State has voted to ban open carry of firearms and other weapons, not just at the state capitol and campuses, but at permitted demonstrations in public spaces around the state. This was Senate Bill 5038. It came after months of protest around the state over the killing of people by law enforcement, as well as demonstrations supportive of former President Donald Trump in the wake of his election defeat. So here's where we're at. You saw the protest pictures the same way I did. Maybe you even attended some. Maybe you attended some as an open carry person, and maybe you attended some supporting that but not carrying, and maybe you attended some as counter-protest, or vice versa. You showed up as open carry to protest or to counter-protest some Black Lives Matter event or an Antifa event, whatever. It's none of it is important. But I will say this. I understand why people are defenders of the Second Amendment. I was out at the shooting range in Bellevue just 2 weekends ago. Had a great time. Shot my friend's AR-15, which I had only shot one before. It was a pretty spectacular weapon. But I will say that I don't have a problem with gun controls. I do actually think that guns should be legal. I don't have a problem with people tracking them. I don't have a problem with people asking for background checks, extensive ones. I think that the liability of an impulse decision with a gun means, and no different than it with a car, means that you need to have plenty of ID before having one. And that's just my opinion. But it doesn't mean that I don't think that they should exist. I'm not terribly worried about government tracking, given the tracking device that I carry in my pocket every day. But you get my drift, and you don't need to hear me preach about that. I'm not changing any minds here. I'm just telling you where I'm at. But where I'm at also is that I do feel like if people show up with any sort of weapon, I'm not talking about handguns. I'm talking about bats. I'm talking about broomsticks. I'm talking about anything that is not clearly a sign. And yes, I know people can repurpose signs into something else. But generally speaking, something that is not a sign at a protest and actually is some form of a weapon, I don't think that they should be there. Not handguns, not anything. You can go there, you can make your placards, you can chant, you can say your piece. As long as you're not throwing punches, as long as you are not doing anything to hurt anyone else, and honestly, I gotta say, as long as you quit with all the window breaking and all of that sort of garbage that happens as well, and you're there to protest, you know, I'll even concede the folks who tie up traffic doing it. I don't like it. I've been tied up in traffic a dozen times with that. I get it, and I get irritated when I'm there. And I also don't think it's, you know, especially if it's a arterial where you need to have fire and ambulance moving through, it actually does have a measure of danger. But setting that aside, I understand that the need and the requirement for public protests, I understand that it brings out more people, that it brings out attention to whatever your cause is, be it a cause considered, you know, relatively considered associated with conservatives, cause that relatively considered associative with liberals, whichever, or somewhere in the middle. But I don't ever see the idea of bringing a weapon of any sort, regardless of whether it's constitutionally protected or your just personal desire. I don't see the value in bringing that in, because it seems to me like that is a measure of provocation in itself. And I'm not talking just about handguns or long guns. I'm talking about the people who walk up. Well, I've seen people walk up with bats. I've seen people walk up with pipes. I've seen people walk up with those things because other people have walked up with guns. I've seen all of that stuff. Having covered protests for years at news organizations, and I've never seen in any situation somebody that whole event of carrying something in become de-escalate anything. Now, is there somebody with a pipe who may not hit somebody with a gun because they're worried about the gun? Yeah, I'll concede that point. But did that person with a pipe, are they agitated when they see someone with a gun? Yeah, probably. And is someone with a gun more likely to pull it and use it in a situation where maybe they might have, I don't know, not done that, or maybe just defended themselves and moved along or moved out of there? And I get it. There are threatening things, but honestly, having been to as many protests as I've been, a lot of times the people who get into trouble are the people who are there looking for it. And I'm not, you know, or the people who decide that they are going to be the one to explain to everyone what's what from an inch away from their face. So this sort of thing, and I know that there's a whole bunch of people out there, and maybe you don't like what I have to say, and I'm sorry about that, because probably personally we could have a beer together and maybe get along. But I don't see, when I've been out to these protests and I've seen people carrying any weapon whatsoever or anything that could be repurposed immediately as a weapon, let's just say you claim you're heading home from baseball practice and you got a bat with you. You know, I don't buy it any more than anyone else does. I do think that those sort of things do nothing toward advancing your political point, defying someone else's political point, and getting to a place where you're having your right to protest, your constitutionally protected right to protest, and still being heard at that point, because no one's actually hearing anything. What they're doing is they're seeing the weapon. That's what they're doing. And they're judging you and the rest of the protest by it. And I don't know that I've ever seen that effective in any manner at any protest that I've been to. But, you know, just one man's thinking. So now it is going to be illegal. Is this going to be challenged in court? And remember, that's, if you want to look it up, that's Senate Bill 5038. Is it going to be challenged in court? Zero question. This is going to be the type of bill that is going to be a lightning rod across the country. It's going to be a rallying point. My guess is the NRA, which I think declared bankruptcy in New York, but is moving to another state, probably a friendlier one. My guess is that there will be a lawsuit or a challenge of some sort. The Pacific Legal Foundation or the NRA or something along those lines is going to step up and say, hey, we feel that this is and I think we feel this is constitutionally protected. And I've got to say, I'm interested in seeing what they do. And I'm interested in seeing the lawsuit. And it could be that a court will find that it is. It doesn't seem to me that you can't still get the same effective protest by not carrying those things in. But nonetheless, I mean, I'll abide by whatever the courts say in that regard. But I got to say, I think that this is actually a move forward for all sides, regardless of political persuasion and regardless of your feelings about the Second Amendment. I think that this de-escalates situations considerably. And I think that the de-escalation is the way we can actually start getting to a place where we can talk to each other again. Again, one man's opinion, right? Coming up on Cairo Night. At the top of the hour, well, we're going to talk a little bit about Seattle's most expensive apartment. Then we're going to talk about an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. She's going to talk a lot about what they are trying to push, what agenda they're trying to push in Olympia right now, given all of the criminal justice reform. And some of it is probably going to surprise you. So join us at the top of the hour coming up.
The end of our journey. What can I do?
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. You know, quite a few years ago when I was a newspaper reporter at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, I ended up getting connected with a local venture capitalist. And she, and I think her husband, I don't know if it was her husband at the time or still her husband, she invited me to check out the apartment she was living in. This apartment is at the top of Smith Tower. And it was a stunner. It was, it still is probably the most interesting apartment I've ever seen. You take an elevator. If you've ever been in the Smith Tower, it's above what is referred to as the Chinese room. You have to take stairs up from there. There's no elevator that goes all the way to the top. At least there wasn't at that time. You take a couple of flights of stairs up, and then you're on that pyramid-shaped structure at the very top of Smith Tower where you see all the small windows, the sort of peaked windows. And she had managed to get rights to that apartment, I mean, just from a leasing standpoint, and then have the interior rebuilt. They literally had to cut out the water tower that had been inside of it and take it down piece by piece because there's no other way to get it out of there in small enough pieces that they could get the pieces down the stairway, and then rebuilt it. And you can see pictures of it right now in the Seattle Times because it's come back up for lease. And I'll tell you a little bit more about it. Then I'm going to tell you the price if you haven't already seen the story. So the way they had it laid out was beautiful. It was sort of an open floor platform, three levels. There was a sort of a main living level, which would be the widest point on on the first floor that you would walk into. And as it got narrower to the top, the second floor was bathroom and sleeping quarters. And then the third was just a little landing. And then you could go from the third floor up through a ladder up into, if you've seen that light on the top of Smith Tower, you can get up in it. It's like being in the Wonkavator. You literally are crawling up. My shoulders were touching on either side on a narrow metal ladder up into it. And then you can sit up there. A couple of people, we sat up there. I think we had like a glass of wine. It was I'm a little bit afraid of heights, although I'll still do stuff. I was nervous sitting up there because it's like you're in this tiny glass bubble sitting well above the city, more than 40 stories above the city. Anyway, that apartment, her lease ran out. And I imagine if she was still living there, I haven't spoken with Petra in a long, long time. If her lease ran out and she could not release it, I bet she's pretty sad about that, because the way they had designed the interior, literally, if you were sitting in the bathtub in one of the rooms, you're right at one of those windows, the window that looked out on Mount Rainier. I've never seen a place like it. Well, it's up available if you are interested. I know that there are eager suitors, so get in line quick at the low, low price of, I think, $15,000 a month. It can be yours. I'm sorry, $17,000 a month. I was wrong. $17,000 a month. It can be yours, although they're limiting all leases, I think, to 5-year leases. Trust me on this one. If you got a shot at it and you've got the dough, and you won the lottery in life, or you just make a ton of money, it will not disappoint. It is windows on every side. It is genuinely one of those things that would end up in Architectural Digest. It's such an interesting apartment. And the nice thing is, and I think this is still true, it's an office building. So it's not like there's a lot of tenants below you. It's mostly office people. And you are above the Chinese Room, which is rented out for wedding receptions and weddings and things like that. I don't know if that is actually a noise creator, but it really, really, really doesn't matter. That place has singularly some of the best views of this region that I have ever seen. And, you know, it would make some sense that, you know, on this massive nighttime show radio salary, that I would rent a place like that. And, you know, and I've been thinking about it, and I could, you know, based on existing cash flow, I could definitely lease a week. No question about that. Leasing a month might not actually work out unless I just sell every single thing that I own. But if you've got the money, you should do it. Coming up on Cairo Nights, we're going to talk with an attorney from the ACLU. So there's a lot of, in fact, we talked about it with Hannah at the beginning of the hour, a lot of police reform stuff moving through the legislature. This is an interesting idea, not yet there, but they're going to be pushing for it, about no bail. State of Illinois has removed all cash bail, and it's an interesting rationale why they did it. You'll want to listen to this conversation. Stay tuned right after the break.